A.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Gulf summit is to focus on security ties.
We are looking for some form of security guarantee, given the behavior of Iran in the region, given the rise of the extremist threat. We definitely want a stronger relationship.
Australia is to slash its foreign aid. U.S. lawmakers discuss extension of a U.S.-China nuclear deal. And the WHO accelerates research and development for disease. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. President Barack Obama's summit with the six Gulf Cooperation Council nations is set to begin without one of the main players, Saudi Arabia's King Salman. Still, the U.S. leader hopes the meeting will help forge a new security relationship between the United States and Gulf nations that feel increasingly threatened by Iran. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
Both the United States and Saudi Arabia have insisted the Saudi king's decision not to attend the summit is not a snub. The White House said those who are needed to get the business done will be present at the meeting, which starts with a dinner Wednesday at the White House, followed by a full day at the presidential retreat at Camp David, Maryland, 100 kilometers north of Washington. On Tuesday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said that business will focus on helping the militaries of Gulf Cooperation Council nations work better with one another.
Obviously, this will be an important opportunity for the United States to deepen and modernize our security cooperation with our GCC partners. Much of the conversation will be focused on what these countries can do to better coordinate their own security measures.
U.S. officials say the presence of the Saudi king is not necessary to engage in conversations on establishing a missile defense system for the region or for talking about more joint exercises and weapons sales. But analysts say it is hard to ignore the tensions between the Obama administration and the Gulf leaders, especially the Saudis, who are deeply skeptical of Mr. Obama's pursuit of an arrangement with Iran aimed at preventing it from developing nuclear weapons. President Obama says the deal would by itself make the region safer, and in announcing a preliminary agreement last month, called it a historic understanding.
I'm convinced that if this framework leads to a final comprehensive deal, it will make our country, our allies, and our world safer.
But Gulf leaders are not so sure the overtures to Iran will make them safer, and some have accused the U.S. administration of not understanding the Iranian threat fully. The Saudis, concerned by the ouster of Yemen's U.S.-supported government by Iran-backed Houthi rebels, launched airstrikes. While those strikes have the support of the Obama administration, they have also been the subject of criticism in Washington. Gulf partners coming to the summit say they want to upgrade their security relationship with the United States. Yusuf Al-Otaiba is the United Arab Emirates ambassador in Washington.
We are looking for some form of security guarantee, given the behavior of Iran in the region, given the rise of the extremist threat. We definitely want a stronger relationship. In the past, we have survived with a gentleman's agreement with the United States about security. I think today we need something in writing. We need something institutionalized.
Obama administration officials say that with a military presence that includes 35,000 troops already in the region, there are no large-scale commitments to be made at the summit. No treaties are to be signed, and with the Saudi king not present, analysts say it is unlikely the summit will go down as a historic new beginning for the U.S. Gulf partnership. But U.S. officials hope it will give all sides a chance to talk and learn more about their differing visions for their future security. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Australia is cutting its foreign aid but will boost its counterterrorism spending in measures outlined in its annual budget. The federal treasurer, Joe Hockey, said Tuesday his financial blueprint would make the country stronger, safer, and more prosperous. Australia's budget deficit has soared to $28 billion as tax revenues and mining royalties fall. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian government is cutting its foreign aid budget by 40% as it tries to balance its accounts at home. Indonesia, which has been the largest overseas recipient of Australian assistance, will see a $175 million reduction in aid. Matt Tinkler, a spokesman for Save the Children Australia, says the poorest will suffer the most.
Who that hits in particular is Indonesia's vulnerable. What it means is less children get vaccinated,
less girls go to school, less women get empowered through work and a job. So it really is the poor people of Indonesia and our region that are going to bear the brunt of this budget's cuts.
Charities have also condemned Australia's decision to slash aid to Africa by 70%. Oxfam has said that in sub-Saharan Africa, the poorest region in the world, Australian assistance is now next to nothing. Critics say it damages Australia's international standing. Officials in Canberra have said the decisions were taken after considering which of its aid recipients were also relief donors to other countries. Economic growth and the capacity of foreign governments to address issues of poverty and need were also considered. Ministers insist cutting assistance to Indonesia wasn't related to the recent execution of two Australian drug smugglers, which has caused diplomatic friction. Australia's budget deficit has doubled as the economy falters under slumping commodity prices, most notably iron ore, its biggest export. Millions more will be spent on national security, and Treasurer Joe Hockey says there'll be extra funds for the fight against extremism.
Madam Speaker, the threat of terrorism is rising and ever-evolving. Tonight, the government is committing an extra $450 million for our intelligence capabilities to ensure that we have the very best equipment and skills necessary to keep our communities safe.
Hockey said this was a budget that unleashes Australia's potential. There'll be tax breaks for small businesses and financial help to families, but critics have said not enough has been done to create new jobs. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A group of U.S. senators heard testimony from top nuclear security officials on the risks and rewards of renewing a treaty on peaceful nuclear power cooperation with China. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee met with the two experts on Tuesday, a day after holding a closed-door meeting with several administration officials to discuss the 30-year-old extension of the bilateral pact. Zlatika Hoek reports.
Administration officials say U.S.-China collaboration in the energy sector, including nuclear energy, remains in the best interest of the United States.
We believe that the strategic, non-proliferation, economic, and environmental benefits of this agreement prove that continuing nuclear cooperation with China is in our best interests.
The renewed agreement with China would allow Beijing to buy more nuclear reactors and additional nuclear technology from the United States. Some of it would help China develop its ability to reprocess plutonium from spent fuel, and according to some experts, could help make its submarines quieter and harder to detect. Lawmakers say the 1985 pact needs to be revised to ensure that China does not divert U.S.-designed nuclear technology to its military programs or sell it to another country.
I think there are concerns about China doing a lot of things that are not in the spirit of the 85 agreement and this extension. So my guess is there may be some conditions attached because of those concerns.
Private entrepreneurs are feared more than state-run industries.
It's the entrepreneurs, the independent business guys that proliferate around China that are the concern. And I think it's China's responsibility under this agreement to make sure that that they police that.
A nuclear security expert from the U.S. Department of Energy said the proposed extension includes provisions to reduce risks of nuclear proliferation.
And it commits both sides, both the United States and China, to deliver export control training to all U.S. and Chinese entities.
U.S. energy officials warned that blocking the agreement could cut off U.S. vendors from an important market and harm the U.S. civil nuclear industry. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Experts at a high-level World Health Organization meeting have agreed on a roadmap for accelerating research and development into new medical products to fight Ebola and other epidemic-prone diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
More than 11,000 people in West Africa lost their lives to Ebola because there were no medical preparations to combat this deadly disease. Scientists, industry representatives, and public health officials attending this two-day WHO meeting agreed the situation cannot be allowed to continue. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says Ebola is not unique in this regard. She says the world was totally unprepared to deal with epidemics of SARS or severe acute respiratory syndrome and the H1N1 bird flu. To remedy this, she says participants are working on a new framework to speed up research and development for diseases that could become epidemics and other health threats. This way, she says, the next time the world is faced with an epidemic, it can respond more quickly and effectively.
If something like Ebola ever happens again to this level, the world needs to be ready with a blueprint, an R&D preparedness plan with clear rules, platform for information sharing, established processes to expedite development and clinical trials, to activate coordinated action and limit the damage.
Dr. Kini says for certain diseases, the development of medical products should be started before a potential outbreak. She says the speed with which new tools for Ebola were developed and clinical trials for vaccines and drugs were set up shows the world can react more quickly than in the past to combat spreading diseases.
We now have commercial diagnostics to detect Ebola and at least two possibly effective vaccines. I say possibly because for the time being we have no proof that they are efficacious indeed. These results should normally have taken 5 to 10 years if you start the time from where we were in August in 2014. And all this was done in less than 10 months. So what is emerging is an interesting model for R&D that reaches far beyond this particular epidemic and disease. It's not only about Ebola.
But Dr. Kini notes the window of opportunity for testing is closing. As Ebola wanes, she notes there may not be enough cases to continue testing the vaccines and several candidate drugs. On Saturday, the WHO declared Liberia Ebola-free, and latest reports show just 7 confirmed cases of Ebola in Guinea and 2 in Sierra Leone. Kini considers this move toward 0 cases in Ebola-ravaged West Africa extremely good news. She says testing can go on in other ways. For example, she says the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, has a pathway called Animal Rule, which uses 2 animal models for judging the safety and efficacy of Ebola medications in humans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A group called the American Freedom Defense Initiative in the U.S. state of Texas recently sponsored a cartoon contest offering a $10,000 prize for a selected drawing of Islam's prophet Muhammad. Many Muslims consider a depiction of the prophet as blasphemy. 2 gunmen arrived on the scene and had a shootout with police, wounding 1 security guard before being shot dead themselves. Pamela Geller is president of the group that sponsored the event, and we asked her why she held the contest.
It was a Muhammad art exhibit and contest held in Garland because in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo jihad slaughter, Muslim groups in Texas, in that same venue, in that same room, held a conference, Stand with the Prophet, in support of the Sharia restrictions on free speech. And it was a pity because what a great time to stand for freedom of speech. So we felt that we ought to stand for freedom of speech, and that's why we did it in that space, in that venue.
We were prepared for some trouble, though.
No. Look, the work that we do has long been controversial. The media self-enforces the Sharia. The media criticizes anyone that opposes the jihad or Sharia. So we always have protection. We always have security at our events. This is going on for years. So I didn't anticipate trouble, but it wasn't entirely surprising.
You were aware that many Muslims find this blasphemous.
I'm not a Muslim. I don't adhere to the Sharia. I find many of the things the media says to be deeply offensive. You know, here's the thing. In a pluralistic society, offensive speech is protected. That's what keeps us free.
And the United States stands for many people being here with different cultures, religions. Do you have respect for these other religions?
I have respect for everyone, but they have to have respect for my free speech. The cartoons are only provocative to those who adhere to the Sharia laws. So I don't.
What do you hope to accomplish with this cartoon contest?
I hope to raise awareness of the encroaching Sharia in this country, which is painfully clear in this latest episode. I mean, this story should not be about me. It should be, first off, about the two jihadists that were killed. What was the ideology? What was the motive? What incited them? The fact that we smoked out a terrorist cell, the fact that we now have the military on the highest since 9/11, bravo, threat alert. I mean, if there was a responsible media, we would be talking about the positive developments from this. But no, it's all about me and my motives. My motives are in defense of freedom.
You feel you're a good American?
I'm a proud American, yeah.
In fairness, we recently had on our program Ibrahim Huber, the National Communications Director for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and he used the word bigot. He accused you of being a bigot. What is your reaction to his remarks?
Of course he did. I don't know why the media has designated them some legitimate authority. CARE was named an unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terrorist funding trial in our nation's history, the Holy Land Foundation trial. The UAE designated CARE a terrorist group. Half of their leadership are serving crimes for jihad-related terror, and you're asking me why he called me a bigot? He's an Islamic supremacist. CARE is a front for Hamas.
Do the Muslims scare you?
No. Losing my freedom scares me. The Muslims don't scare me. The Muslims are lovely. I have a problem with the ideology. I have a problem with jihadic doctrine, and I have a problem with the most brutal and extreme system of governance on the face of the earth, the Sharia.
Pamela Geller, president of American Freedom Defense Initiative. ISIS claimed responsibility for the shooting at the Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas and warned of more attacks to come. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with American Muslim scholar Yasser Qadhi, professor of religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, about the fine lines between freedoms of speech and hate speech and why some Muslims resort to violence or terrorism out of anger.
Professor Qadhi, if Prophet Muhammad himself did not respond to personal attacks and mocking by violence, how would some Muslims today kill people who draw cartoons depicting the Prophet?
That's a very good question. We all know as Muslims that the Prophet Muhammad always turned the other cheek. He was very forgiving to those who opposed him. And this is the image that Muslims have of the Prophet. Now, it is true that some people outside the faith try to portray the Prophet as a warmonger, as this and that. But the image that Muslims have of their Prophet is really similar to the image that Christians have of Jesus. And that is that he was a loving, a peaceful Prophet who forgave his opponents. And there are many instances in the life of the Prophet that Muslims grew up hearing about. So the question arises, where is this anger and where is this justification coming from? And the response to this is that one cannot ignore the socio-political context from within which these provocations arise. The fact of the matter is that Islam has been slandered for the last 14 centuries. Like every religion, people go back and forth. But it is not common in the history of Islam to have radical terrorist groups or to have vigilantes going and killing people, you know, who defamed the Prophet. This is a relatively modern phenomenon. The very notion of Islamic terrorism is relatively modern. It only goes back to the 70s and early 80s. And one does need to ask, why is this happening only recently? And the response is that one cannot ignore the political dimension, pre-colonialism, post-colonialism, the invasions of so many Muslim lands, the support of dictator regimes. All of these things are not simply disparate issues. They are interconnected. And when a community feels marginalized, and I can assure you the Muslim community is feeling marginalized. Any type of attack on that which is sacred and holy kind of brings out all of those emotions, all of those tensions. And it is a sad reality that, yes, when you attack the Prophet, you are going to get these reactions. It's almost inevitable. Pamela Geller did seem to be instigating and gleefully accepting the fact that she was attacked. She was banking on it because it did boost her to a level of popularity that she now has.
But Professor, American Muslim youth had been spared the alienation that fostered militancy in Europe. How do you explain homegrown terrorism by some Muslim Americans?
You know, I used to say around 6-7 years ago that all Islamic jihadist terrorist attacks by Muslims have occurred by people who were not born and raised in America. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we've actually seen a few instances, just a handful, and the two individuals as well that were responsible for the Dallas shooting, they are as well American. The one was a convert and the other was born and raised here from a Muslim father. It's just a sad reality that, unfortunately, unless we take a step back and ask ourselves why there is so much anger. I mean, again, let me give you an analogous situation. Look at Ferguson, look at Baltimore, look at the tensions within the African-American and the larger dominant Caucasian populations. You cannot dissociate this ongoing narrative. And if a young African-American does something, let's say in New York, you can ask him, why would you get irritated when you're not in Ferguson, you're not in Baltimore? But see, there is this alliance. There is this notion of all of us are being attacked. And frankly, there's an element of truth in that narrative. So it is true that, yes, eventually even American Muslims will fall prey to that narrative that ISIS is spreading, that other groups are spreading, that all Muslims are under attack, all Muslims are under siege, that they're out to get you. This war on terror is nothing other than a war on Islam. And when we continue our foreign policies, we continue our drones and our assassinations and our supporting of military dictators, when we selectively choose who to defend and who not to defend, i.e. the innocent Syrians that are being massacred, they're not being defended. When we selectively choose, then that narrative is given certain, you know, credence, and people do fall prey to it. And this is not a justification. Of course, I strongly disagree with that narrative, but it is inevitable when blood is continued to be shed, when violence is continued to be perpetrated, that more and more people will identify with the victims and feel that they need to do something against those whom they view as being actively involved in propagating that violence.
American Muslim scholar Yasser Qadhi, professor of religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Thursday on International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government and opposition in South Sudan continue to engage in armed conflict, despite an agreement to end hostilities that have resulted in the death of thousands of innocent South Sudanese citizens and the displacement of over 2 million more. With both sides dug in, the compromises needed to achieve a viable peace agreement remain elusive, putting the future of the world's youngest nation at grave risk. Many South Sudanese have long urged that those responsible for these crimes be held accountable, to break the cycle of violence and revenge, and seek to build a stable, lasting peace. Early this month, the United States announced plans to provide $5 million to promote justice and accountability in South Sudan, pending congressional approval. These funds will support a credible, impartial, and effective justice mechanism, such as a hybrid court, to hold perpetrators of violence in South Sudan to account. Furthermore, the funding will build the capacity of South Sudanese civil society to document human rights violations, work that is critical to understanding events on the ground and that can serve as a starting point for justice and reconciliation efforts. The funds are in addition to ongoing U.S. support for local reconciliation efforts and the more than $1 billion that the United States has contributed to assist humanitarian relief since the start of the crisis in December 2013. The United States continues to stand with the people of South Sudan and will not tolerate impunity for human rights abuses, but will continue to push for peace. We urge others to join us in committing funds to support justice, reconciliation, and healing in South Sudan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.